Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I sense no future, but time seems to drag. No time, but it's gotta love. No flag waving high above. No sign for the dark place that I live. No God for the damn bad I don't give.
From newsounds.org, this is another remote edition of the Soundcheck podcast. I'm John Schaefer. This music comes from Elvis Costello's new album called Hey Clockface. This is not a representative track from the album, mainly because there is no representative track. Hey Clockface includes a spoken word soundscape, songs with an old-time jazz flavor, torchy ballads, and this snarling little number called No Flag. Some of the album's most striking tracks were created with the trumpeter, composer, and bandleader Michael Lennart, and with electric guitarist Bill Frisell. And today on Soundcheck, both Elvis Costello and Michael Lennart join us. Now, Elvis, Michael, you guys have proven throughout your careers that you're serial collaborators. Elvis, how did you first come to work with Michael?
Well, you know, the working together is a very recent thing. I have to say that Michael may not realize this, but he sort of hove into view like, the rescue posse, because I had found myself suddenly sort of catapulted back from a tour of the UK, which had been preceded by 5 days of recording sessions, three in Helsinki all on my own and two with a wonderful ensemble in Paris. And I had no thought then that in itself was an album. I had plans to, I had a couple other recording sessions booked, which of course immediately had to be cancelled, as was everything else. And I'm suddenly sheltering in a cabin on Vancouver Island with my wife and my children, the way everybody is retreating to somewhere where they felt secure. When I get a note from Michael, who's a near neighbor of ours, where we live some of the time in New York, with the idea of working on this piece of music that he had put together with Bill Frisell and Nels Klein and other musicians from his orchestra. And I will hand it to Michael to correct me on that.
No, I mean, that's more or less it. My memory goes back. We did one date in Molde, Norway, in like 2007. You were with Alan Toussaint, and I was with Steely Dan. Yeah. And there was no interaction musically on stage. You guys went first, we went second. And then years later, when you guys did the double bill, you and the Imposters did the double bill with Steely Dan.
So then, well, that was great. Yeah,
so
yeah.
Now yeah. We're out on the road for fun. 6 weeks. And again, there wasn't a lot of interaction, but now we're sharing sound checks and broken equipment and hitting soccer balls backstage.
And you know, you must have been aware of the fact there were some times when, you know, the Steely Dan's audience kind of like regarded me and the Imposters like somebody had let the barbarians through
but
the
I,
gates, you know, like
I,
we're playing this kind of hot. I, as the tour went on, I remember I said, at first I was trying to be ingratiating, you know, with a couple of songs they might kind of like that had a couple of clever chords in. And by the end of it, I said, no, let's just play like, let's do just a 7 minute wig out to open the show and just to hell with it. Let's not even play nice.
And that further endeared me because I went, okay, this guy, you're just going to do your thing. And that's, you always struck me as someone that has an adventurous spirit. And I take rejection very well. So in my collaborations, I'll throw things out. And if someone doesn't like something, cool. Well, there's another, there's enough ideas. So in all the backstage and talking and everything, when the pandemic hit, I said, okay, this is going to be a freaky couple months. What do I have in the vault? Let me see. What would be cool? Who can I imagine? And as I was saying to you, John, now that up is down and down is up, creatively, you find yourself thinking of new things. Mm-hmm. So I said, you know, I'm going to send Elvis the track. And I think it was that night you sent something back, a lyric, and I went, wow, that was, again, it was confirmed that you're fearless.
They say I have a perfect face for radio and a trumpet for listening, a cheek to turn to you, an eye for glistening. Tear that tear from me. Hold it in your memory. Pull away the powder and the pain-painted dream of this and that disgrace. A silver band of marching souls. A button of brass, an epaulet of gold. That Lenten light, that slight fanfare that consoles. That trivial, sniveling rosary, that ring-a-ding rosemary. Condemned a man, alas, at last at Requiem Mass.
Well, the way it sounded to me, I mean, obviously, when you told me Bill was involved, Bill and I have been friends a long time.
That's Bill Frisell, of course. Yeah,
yeah. Bill and I played on Hal Wilner's wonderful record of Charles Mingus music. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the wildest sessions I've ever been on. Bill played the role that you played in the making of my album, Hey Clockface, because I was in a studio in Astoria, and this was the lineup. It was Don Elias, Michael Blair, Mark Rebo, Art Maurer, and Henry Threadgill.
That's for Weird Nightmare?
Greg Cohen. Did I mention that hardly any of those people were playing the instruments they're known for? They were all playing the contraptions and inventions of Harry Parch.
Yeah.
And we were playing Weird Nightmare in something approximating D minor. But given that Parch's instruments all were tuned microtonally, there was just this overtone chaos in my cans. And I'm resolutely trying to stay in D minor and sing the tune against this percussive. And then on the bridge, Bill arrived with Greg Cohen, like, thank you. He's come to my rescue with a beautiful
lighthouse.
Chord.
I got to the
bridge. And so I'd known him since then and appreciated his works from before that.
Weird nightmare, pain and misery in a heart that's loved and turn in fright with the fear that I'll live it all again in my dream.
Elvis, it's interesting you mention, you know, the microtonal tuning of the Harry Parch instruments. They're 43 mm-hmm. notes to the octave, and the reason Parch did that was he wanted to be able to notate music that followed the inflections and the patterns and the melodies of American English speech. And there are a couple of tracks on this record, including the one that ultimately, you know, turned out to be this collaboration,
yeah.
Radio is Everything, yeah. where you are, in fact, speaking. It's mm-hmm. one of a couple of spoken word tracks on the record. How does a decision like that get made in the context of the bigger album picture?
Well, it at that stage, I thought I was contributing to Michael's record, you know. He had asked me specifically to do that. I listened to the music, and it's obvious that that piece did not have typical, you know, anything like a typical verse, chorus, bridge structure. It was an open-ended piece that developed, and these events happened in the course of it. You know, rhythm, eventually it was joined in a rhythmic agreement in something like a groove, but it was very open. And I opened my notebook to some verses I've been working on. And, you know, the process of writing songs is often to discard lots of good lines that are, you know, because of their irregular length, or you know, there's no way to confine them with a melody or a verse structure. And I just was reading them in my head while listening to the music. And the second time or third time round, I gather things fairly quickly. And I had memorized the structure of the piece, and I just started reading it just spontaneously. So what you hear is effectively a recording of me writing the song as it was from my perspective. I'm landing the images of that text in reaction to the composition that Michael had constructed in the studio from these component parts.
You don't need to see my face. Radio is everything. You don't need to know my name. Radio is everything. The lie that I tell, it just doesn't matter. If I should deceive you, or if I should flatter. If your bankroll gets thin while some kitty gets fatter. Radio is everything. From the straight to the narrow. To the broadcast from within.
To me, that's the same thing as a soloist taking off from a set of changes and acknowledge, you know, having a relationship to the harmony and to the rhythm. It's the same idea, in instinct anyway. And I could have said everything twice the speed. I could have said it at half the speed, but I didn't. And I left the pauses I did because I'd memorized where particular events happened. And then when I listened back, there were even more happy accidents in the way that little episodes in the music agreed with images and the lyric in a way that had to be some kind of alchemy, you know, that you couldn't really have predicted it. You would have had to do the reverse and read the music first and then score the words, you know, to get, achieve that. So I didn't mistrust it for, you know, once. Rather than doing that editorial thing or making something much more conventional, I thought, well, its very unconventional structure is what makes it beautiful.
I don't even know if there were drums on the first version I sent you. Do you remember?
No, I think you added those. That's right. I think you added those. Maybe because I picked up, maybe then I became more like a dialogue. I know that's definitely the case with the second piece, because you sent me then what became Newspaper Pain, which was, you know, much more rhythmically driven. But again, where I chose to lay the words sort of ignored the suggestion of a verse chorus structure and kind of made a, you know, the drop came right in the middle of what might have been perceived to be a chorus.
Right.
And that didn't bother me any. And then you then wrote the horn arrangement kind of like, you know, commenting around the words as I'd laid them down. And that was much more driven by a rhythm section and the whole figuration that you were playing, you know?
And I love that, and the form was atypical.
It becomes a dialogue. It becomes a dialogue, and that's what we're trying to have, you know?
Yeah.
To keep out the nonsense and block out the needing. To keep up her spirits with improving reading. But the ink from the columns dissolved down into the stain. And the bare wood floor that extended to the dawn. Is a bright future somehow ignored. How they offered her fine reach she could never afford. Tempting out savings she didn't have or could never risk. Not a fashionable kindness. It was grotesque. The bows with their fiddles played the rascal's release. We toasted to valor and wish there were peace. 6 months later in a newspaper margin.
So I want to get back to Newspaper Pain in a minute, but before we leave Radio Is Everything behind, because of course that's a title that appeals to me quite a lot, Michael, I have to ask you, there's a lovely kind of nocturnal trumpet solo at the end of that.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was on the original or whether that got added in later, but it reminds me, are you familiar with Aaron Copland's piece, Quiet City?
Oh, yeah. I've tried to play that a couple times.
Well, I think you kind of succeeded in this piece, you know?
Oh, well, I didn't. That didn't occur to me at all. But yeah, I mean, I see what you mean.
So was that part of the original mix that you would have sent to Elvis, or?
No, I think it was just a soundscape. I sent him a very blank canvas with some harmonic movement, but it was very filmic. There was not a lot of rhythm. There was some of my stuff, some of Frizzell's stuff. I think one loop of Nels Klein. And that was it.
I think I'd be surprised if I listened again now to the, because it seems so vivid to me. It seemed as if everything was there when I you know, performed the words. But of course, that isn't the case at all. So, you know, who can say the way these things are supposed to? I think there were suggestions of things, but certainly the things that you added, I was so delighted that when that happened, you know, that when that trumpet appeared on the mix, when the rhythm appeared at the end, it just sort of confirmed my instincts about where the emphasis lay.
Yeah, I mean, for me, John, if anything, there was a ghost of Chet and shipbuilding, you know, hanging over, which I kind of want to put to the side. I mean, it's so beautiful, but that occurred to me, and I just said, you know, I'm going to put that. I'll just play my own thing.
Yeah. So. I also was wondering if you had picked up, I hear like lingering echoes of Raymond Chandler. Ooh. In some of Elvis's spoken, you know, there are just phrases that sound like they could have come out of The Big Sleep or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that noirish quality you seem to have really captured
it's
in
like
that
song. Beat, you know, I always love Lou Rawls and Axelrod, that kind of, this is the combination. I think of it as beat poetry, you know.
Mm.
It's been attractive to me, obviously, since the very beginning. The first record I ever made. I mean, I made an album in 1976-77, which was my first professional album, my first serious recording session. But I didn't know anything about the studio. You know, I didn't know. It was just a recording of some people playing in a room that happened to sound good because the musicians were so good and I had some good songs. And then I made one record with a sort of interim lineup of a borrowed rhythm section. It was similar in a way to this. It wasn't somebody I worked with all the time. You know, that was Watching the Detectives.
Cut the baby digging up her clothes. Close up with his hand that says we never close. You snatch a chew and you match your cigarette. She pulls the eyes out with a face like a magnet. I don't know how much more of this I can take. She's filing her nails while they're dragging the lake. She's watching the detectives. Oh, he's so cute. She's watching the detectives.
And that, of course, has a lot of noir imagery in it.
Absolutely.
And but very much a young person's view of what those images meant. And I've returned to it. I've written songs with titles that sound like noir books. And I've tried to kind of tell different tales down the years using the sort of atmosphere that one picks up from watching a lot of late night movies. I think it's probably something a lot of musicians have an awareness of, whether or not they've ever read any of that literature on which those films were based. It's more that one is the music appears in them. The music that appears in a lot of late 40s films is idiomatically closer to jazz. It's moving away from, you know,
the kind of classical cinema stuff of
the 30s. from Eric Korngold, yes. Even great composers, toward, you know, you're seeing John Mandel, not
yeah,
Johnny
right,
Mandel,
or John Johnny
Mandel.
T. Williams.
Yeah, John Mandel writing the score of of I Want to Live, you know, with Susan Hayward. So you get these great scores, and of course that all, as a little kid, we had American television shows that seemed a lot slicker and more and better produced than the Rumpty Dumpty kind of music that we had on the BBC. So you'd get something even that would sound corny to us now, but something like 77 Sunset Strip, you know, that would sound like hip if you were 5 years old and these people like finger clicking and then... You know, you don't. What's that? You know, there's nothing like that on the BBC. They don't even allow that. You know, they don't allow that kind of finger snapping stuff. And then there's all those. You know, there's Henry Mancini and all of these people that are that stuff was all, you know, there's most music in England was very straight, you know. Yeah. It was very there were some great jazz musicians that, but they didn't, they, you know, and there were some great scores in the early 60s written by people like Johnny Dankworth, you know. Yeah. and John Barry, you know, John Barry's early music, which was very from jazz. I heard all that in the movies.
And he was a trumpet player.
So so movie music is very influential on in the mood, not necessarily in, I don't have the knowledge of music to always, you know, replicate what those ideas are, but the atmosphere really affects the images and lyrics, especially.
And there are moments throughout Hey Clockface, the new record, that, I mean, there are actual moments of jazz. The Fats Waller tune, How Can You Face Me, is, you know, part of this medley with the title track, Hey uh-huh. Clockface.
Well, you know, strangely enough, the trumpet player didn't know that song. he, you know, I think these guys I was working with in Paris are from a different place. That's, but you know, they play some jazz, some classical music, some popular music. And the thing I loved about them is that none of them asked for a passport traveling between those lands. Mm. You know, they had a very open mind to the music, and we didn't have any written music either, except chord charts.
The movement is unwound. Don't tick a tock or did it make a sound? Hey, Clockface, well, don't you ever dare count me down to zero. I will wait, be waiting here. A minute from departure, I will twist your key and have her come back to me. Have her come back to me. How can you face me after what I've been through? After you broke that vow, how can you face me now? How can you face me now? How can you face me now?
So when we did Hey Clockface, obviously it is a song that borrows the clothes of a song from the 1930s. I was aware of that. I've been doing that since I was 19. I haven't done it all the time, mm-hmm. but I've been doing... I could point to songs I wrote when I was 19 that I've recorded since that have that kind of harmonic language and stylistic sort of stamp. This one, it I realized just as we were coming to perform it that it had the same harmony as How Can You Face Me. I didn't base it on that song. And I said, why don't we play that as the intro? And Mikhail didn't know it. So I said, I'll sing it with you. And then it won't be one thing or the other. And then you can play off the changes at the end. And as you hear, he does. And I said, I'll sing the last four lines of the recording will be a quotation. And it's great because then, you know, I get to have that line there where the two compositions are joined together. That's a beautiful thing, you know.
What about the song, I Can't Say Her Name? Is that... Ain't Misbehavin' Redux?
Some people said that. I can hear half a dozen different songs that have fed their way into that. I mean, it has a similar, again, you can find that harmony in, 2,000 songs from 1929 to 1935 or something like that.
I've been left in the dark. Shine a light right in my eyes. You'll never make me talk. Alibis I must protect. An alias you won't detect. I won't place the blame. I can't say her name. I whisper it so soft and slow. When I think no one's listening, no one knows the thought of her so strong and slow stays on my mind. I won't ever let her go.
I remember, you know, there's a Joe Bassard, the collector. He said, there's no good music made after 1927. And on a certain day, I'd agree with him. You know, it's like everything you want to say. I mean,
it's been said.
1927,
yeah.
The year of My Blue Heaven, you know. I mean, what do you need to say after My Blue Heaven? Nothing. You know,
But it wasn't intentional. It wasn't like using the bump.
No, yeah. No, not at all. No, again, and the only thing that was intentional, again, was the acknowledgement of Ukulele Ike at the end. Was to, I've never done it before. I don't scat sing, but I can F. that is effing. Uh-huh. That's actually what it's called. That kind of falsetto.
Right.
Wordless singing is something Cliff Edwards did. Ukulele Ike, and I love Ukulele Ike. I thought, well, we'll have a little salute to Ukulele Ike. What better thing to do in the Le Studio Saint-Germain? They understand that.
You know, it always kills me how much you love music, Elvis. That's you know, like you're like a kid.
I mean, you got to say that this record goes from a clattery sort of noise that I made in a playroom in Helsinki to something very concentrated, and I had these ballads which I knew were, many of them were quite melancholic. So it was a great release, just in, you know, you, even when you're doing something serious, Michael backed me up on this, if this music can be serious, but you must be joyful in the act of making it. So sometimes manifesting that joy, even if it's just in the tag of a song, I mean, I can't say a name, is just a little miniature song. And then just to break into tempo at the end and let the players play, and in a kind of a style we all know as being derived from New Orleans music, where more than one person soloing at the same time, you know, so there's three of us soloing at the same time. There's nothing the matter with that. That's just letting fly for that few bars, and then we're into something else. You know, it's preceded by Radio Is Everything and succeeded by a song called Byline, which is a lovely way to close.
Yeah, you know? It really is. Now, Elvis, you said earlier that, you know, when Michael first sent you the recording that would become the song Radio Is Everything, that you thought you were working on a song for his record. Obviously, that is not the way it turned out. Both Newspaper Pain and Radio
Is
Everything are on your record.
Michael, correct me if I'm wrong here. I think the intention is we might conceivably release these songs on both records.
Yeah, your record comes out first, but I'm trying to think of a way of adding a separate mix or doing something that makes it slightly different, like an alternate mix. But I think we're going to release it on my next orchestra, on my Michael Enhart Orchestra album.
Yeah, I think, you know, you have to remind yourself that there are people walking in the door that are hearing you from the first time, no matter what your reputation says. If you can have the biggest billing in the world, and somebody's hearing is never shown a shred of curiosity about what you do. And I know, having, you know, been now a professional musician for 43 years and performing for over 50, that there are people whose first experience of anything I've written is something that I wrote in the last 20 years. And they've maybe gone back and checked out those other records, but they maybe don't relate to them in the same way as people who were there when they first came out.
Yeah.
So why not? You know, there were people in Michael's audience who would hear this composition that we've created together for the first time in the context of his music. And more importantly, like, that, you know, that we continued on. We, you know, there's the second piece on the record, Newspaper Pain, which is a much more driven piece, and then there's still a more rhythmic piece, which is a separate release, which is credited to Michael's orchestra, and which I'm one of the vocalists.
Right.
So that's, you know, that's the way it works. You know, there's no rule book that says how we should be doing this anymore.
And we didn't have a plan as to where it would come out. And I love that. We were just kind of creating these things. At first, it was one piece. And then a second, it was kind of like a balm for the soul during this crazy time. There's something else that occurred to me a minute ago, which is that doing these things, you know, you're talking about creating in Finland in a room, in a jazz setting, interacting. Mm. There's a danger of doing things remotely as we did, which to me is like comedy writing, and that you get one chance for it to be fresh. So this back and forth, no matter how experienced or creative people are, you get, to me, one chance each time. And then it becomes cerebral and becomes overcooked. So this idea of you sending me back these lyrics and me sculpting and going, okay, I got another round, I'm going to send it to you, and you send it back, and then we're done. There's kind of flying by the seat of your pants, which I loved. It's like, you know, comedy writing. If you do it remotely,
here's something. I learned a valuable lesson from a very famous musician in this time, My friend Ben Jaffe asked me to be part of a benefit that sort of video link event for Preservation Hall, and I did a number. I played with Preservation Hall at the hall, and we've done a few appearances together where they've augmented things I've been doing. So we had some shared repertoire, and then they said, in the finale, we're going to do The Saints. Now, it's a song I would never consider singing, you know. But they said, we really want all the participants in the gala to sing The Saints. So I'm on my back porch, with a little video camera set up, and I'm singing like this. Oh, when the saints come marching in. And I'm afraid somebody's seeing me looking foolish, And... I'm singing it so quietly. I have a really loud voice. This is the quietest recording that you will ever hear of me singing, because there was something, I hadn't yet got let go of the fear of doing something in isolation on my own. I'm used to being in the studio with a clock on the wall and you're in a booth with headphones on. I'm suddenly just talking to a camera and feeling like a complete idiot. Then I saw the finished thing. They edited it all together and they go, and now... Sir Paul McCartney, and they cut to a booth, and Paul picks up a trumpet and goes, bop, 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 bop. Okay, I don't think Hot Lips McCartney would claim to be a great trumpet player, but you know what was beautiful about it was he didn't give a damn. What was important was we were all doing this thing together, and sure enough, my little face popped up whispering a few words, and other people thankfully sang more lustily, and that really taught me a lesson about this moment, that you have to be prepared to feel foolish, and doesn't matter. And in fact, my experience of this is that isolated recording is making us more daring, not more. After I got over that, I realized I had nothing to lose. Nobody was looking at me. I could try that mad idea that I would never try if I was in a room with six other people, and it might just work. There it is. When the saints go marching, yes, I want to be in that number. When the saints go marching, yes, when the saints go marching in, go marching in. Oh, when the saints go marching in, go marching in.
Well, I want to ask about the third and final collaboration between the two of you. Michael, this song, Shut Him Down, features Elvis, and the rapper, is it Jay Swiss? Is that how
Jay
he
Swiss,
says
it? Yeah.
Yeah. You've worked with him on a couple of things, right?
Yeah, he joined my orchestra last year around July. I brought him in for one show. We hit it off. He became a regular member. We just kept on finding new material. And so, it took a real skill to flow over 22 people.
Yeah.
And he did it. And then we started talking about having a duo. And then in isolation with the pandemic, we started writing and remotely, and we finished all this stuff. And we had a song that I sent to Elvis called Blackout, and Elvis loved it. And I initially didn't think of bringing in Jay Swiss for this, but everything was happening in the moment. I knew that Elvis was open to it. And I said, you know what? If I can find a groove, if it doesn't feel, like a square and a circle, maybe Jay could join. And so I sent him this midsection. I sent him Elvis's lyrics, and it worked out incredibly. And then I got the 70
he
musicians.
He picks up just like one or two images from what I just sung and melds them into something of his own. And then he goes, switch, back to me.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd love that handover. it's just, it felt like we were still sort of doing it in a moment.
Yeah.
They're just a series of joined up moments. They're not overly considered. They still seem like to have the spontaneity that we look for in everything that you try to do.
And that's a dangerous transition to try and get back. I mean, that was tough to mix because you're going from one feel to another feel with a different singer and then getting back to it in terms of energy. Not only do you have to sustain the energy, but you have to keep on lifting. But it worked out, so,
Doubt enter the minds, you gotta purge it. Praise from an end to the week like Sunday service. Walk in it, world might be dark, but I'm in the right spirits. That voice of doubt, don't gotta listen, although you hear it one time, that don't make it true. 1,000 times to make your mind up and make it through. Swiss.
Dreamed pale by the cunning and the cool. The camera and projector, the running of the room.
We're like another tailpiece, this spinning love. Is it something once? Does it make it true to me or you or anyone who knew? Shut him down, shut him down. You're running through. 100 times you didn't, 1,000 times you do.
Well, you're riding a really sturdy groove there. Do I hear a little hint of Fela Kuti, of Afrobeat?
I think more than a hint, yeah.
Okay. Well, very well done. And so there will be, obviously, Hey Clockface is Elvis Costello's new record, and Michael Lenhart and Jay Swiss. You guys have an EP, right? The Alchemy coming soon?
The Alchemy EP, yeah.
Yeah, in January. I'm looking forward to that.
In January. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, Elvis, Michael, congratulations. I know it's just, quote unquote, just three songs, but it's three songs that you guys have sort of conjured
so
out of nothing during...
So far.
Right, right. Who knows? Who knows?
Well, very well done. And thank you guys for joining us.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Elvis Costello and Michael Lenhart talking about Elvis's new record, Hey Clockface, and their ongoing and wide-ranging collaboration. Soundcheck's technical director is Irene Trudell. Our producer is Karen Havlick. I'm John Schaefer. Hear our prior conversation with Elvis Costello at newsounds.org.
Cold as stone, hard as winter, she turned to me, and this she said, kiss me once. And you'll remember, lay with me till we're both dead. The land was white, the wind a dagger. Life beats a poor man to his grave. Love makes a rich man from a beggar. Love is the one thing we can save.